following interview with Robert W. Comer by William Burr took place in Washington, D.C. on April 27, 1987. The interview is part of a joint project by the Columbia University Oral History Office and the Foundation for Iranian Studies.
Before we get to the NSC in Iran, I'd like to ask some background questions. Where were you born and raised?
Chicago, and raised in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. And received most of your education, your primary education in St. Louis?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And your college education?
Harvard, class of 42.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you serve in World War II?
Yes.
Army or?
Army.
Uh-huh. Europe or? Pacific or?
Europe. Uh-huh. Okay. Mediterranean.
Okay. Did you go to school after the war?
Yes, I graduated from Harvard Business School.
The MBA.
MBA.
Uh-huh. Now how was it that you came to join the CIA in 1947?
Some old friends of mine from World War II days told me that the war wasn't over, we just had a different enemy. And it was nationally important. We set up a new intelligence agency. And that I would be an ideal candidate.
What division did you go to work for at first?
Western European and international affairs, international organizations.
Is that the analytical branch? Or
yes, the analytical branch.
Uh-huh. And who was your boss there at that point?
Julian Rosenberg.
And your duties at the branch?
I was the first NATO analyst. And I did something on the United Nations and its subsidiary organizations. But I later came to specialize in the European multinational organizations.
Like the OEEC and Marshall Plan? Did you look at Marshall Plan developments
yes,
at all?
Mm-hmm.
So just monitor, kept track of them? Did your duties at CIA change over the years?
Yes.
Where did you?
I went up to the Office of National Estimates. I joined CIA before it was called CIA, but that happened a few months later. And then I joined the new Office of National Estimates that Beadle Smith was creating. He brought down Professor Langer from Harvard to head the new office. And Langer said, who do I want on my staff? And he picked two of us who had studied under him, Ray Klein and myself. So I was a charter member of the office. I became a Western European estimator and head of the Western European part of the staff. Then I became head of the Middle East part of the staff, then deputy chief of the estimate staff, then chief of the estimate staff. Then I went off to the National War College, came back and spent a year with the Soviet staff, and then left ONE. Became the assistant to Robert Amory, who was the Deputy Director for Intelligence. And my main function was to be the agency's liaison with the National Security Council staff.
But what year was this?
I think it was 58. Mm-hmm. And then I spent half my time over at the NSC. I was the alternate planning board member. Amory was the planning board member. He got so disaffected with the NSC and with the administration that he never went to meetings. So I became the planning board member. And it was interesting.
Now, you mentioned a minute ago that you worked in the Middle East staff of ONE for a while. Did you do any research on Iran? Or?
I don't think so. I kept track of Iran, but I didn't do any. I don't remember anything about that period. About Iran.
In any detail. And then at the NSC Planning Board, that's 58, was there any Iran work that you might have?
I don't think so.
They did a number of NSC studies on Iran.
Did they do any from 58 to 60?
Yeah, they did updates on their basic policy statement.
Oh, really?
And that's, as far as I know, things I've seen that were declassified, but...
Well, I was drawn off for about a year to be the CIA detailee to Charlie Coolidge's study of disarmament, of arms control. So it could have happened during that period, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So your the Iran work really started with the Kennedy administration. Work on Iran.
Yes.
Okay. Now, what were the circumstances that brought you in to the Kennedy NSC staff?
Well, Kennedy and Bundy decided to dismantle the NSC machinery that had been created under Eisenhower. And since that would put me out of a job, I wrote Mac Bundy a little note saying, "You've broken my rice bowl. But I think it's a great idea to get rid of these things. They were paper mills." And it was a little two-paragraph letter, but 2 days later I got a call from Bundy. And he said, "Look, we got your letter. We appreciate it. How'd you like to come over and talk about it a little bit?" I said, "Certainly." He said, "Well, when could you come over?" I said, "How about right now?" We agreed on the afternoon. I went over. And Bundy and Rostow were in the office, and we talked for about 10 minutes about the NSC machinery under Eisenhower, and he said, "Well, that's enough of that. We seem to be on the same frequency. Let's talk about a few other things." They asked me some questions or posed some propositions, and we discussed them, and after about an hour, Bundy said, "How'd you like to work for the president?" Well, I said, "I'm a Democrat. And I'd be delighted to. I'll resign from the agency." So I went back and I told Amory I was leaving and going over to the new NSC, where I was the first man they hired on the foreign policy side. And I went down to say goodbye to Alan Dulles. And he said, "Bob, you don't have to resign from the agency to go over to the White House." He said, "I'll give you an unlimited leave of absence." I said, "No, sir, I would rather resign. I don't want to be looked on as anybody's inside man at the Skunk Works." And then I thought a little bit that had been a bit rude. So I said, "In any case, if I've been any good, I'm sure that you all will be happy to have me back so that I don't lose much by resigning." Well, he grinned and said, "That's fine." Gave me a picture. There's the damn picture. There. And off I went. And I guess within a week after I'd arrived, Bundy came in one morning. We had a meeting every day practically. And said, "I have a letter here from the Shah to the president. And it needs an answer." So I said, "Mac," we were feeling each other out at this point. I said, "Mac, I bet I can tell you what the letter says without reading it." And Bundy said, "All right, fall on your face." So I said, "The Shah writes the president how happy he is to have a new, young, active president of the United States, who he is sure will understand the world the way the Shah sees it, and that he is surrounded by enemies, not just the Soviets, but Gamal Abdel Nasser and others, and that he desperately needs some more military equipment, and that he hopes the new president be smarter than the old president and will give him or sell him this equipment." Mac looked at me and he said, "By God, you did it." That's exactly what the letter says. Well, I said I wouldn't give him a plug nickel. His problems are internal more than external. He has always seen the Soviets and NASDAQ as about 8 times larger than they really are. Max said, you don't have to go on. Take the point. He said, and because you've been so good, you can write the answer for Kennedy's signature. Well, I took it over to Talbot, the State Department, and we concocted an answer, and I Englished it a bit. The president looked at it, may have changed a word or two, and signed it. Well, since I had handled the first Iranian letter, I became, by a process of osmosis, the Iranian guy in the White House. And then, being the Iranian guy, it was easy enough to become the Turkish guy and the Pakistani guy and the Indian guy, and I ended up being the Middle East, South Asia man in the White House staff. Originally, Bundy said, look, don't send stuff directly to the president. Send it to the president through me. I mean, mark it for the president, but run it through my office. Because until we know each other better, I'd sort of like to keep my hand on everything that goes to the president, because I'm the guy he's going to ask about. So that was fine. And he sent forward a very high proportion of the stuff that I prepared. Sometimes he sent it back to me with a question or just an add-in or something like that. And my empire grew out to the Straits of Gibraltar, because the states of the southern Mediterranean littoral were all Arab states. And then Christmas of 1961, I made the mistake of going home for Christmas. Came back and found that Bundy had given me the rest of Africa. We had a guy, I forget his name at the moment, from State who'd been handling that. He promoted himself a job as political counselor in London. So instead of getting a new guy, Mac gave it to me. So I had all of Africa and all the area from the Straits of Gibraltar to Burma. Well, I said, Mac, I can't follow all of this without a couple of assistants. So he said, recruit a couple of assistants. And the guy I brought in from State was a man named Rick Haynes, a black officer, brilliant guy. He handled most of Africa south of the Sahara, left me after a year, went into business in New York, and when Jimmy Carter came in, they appointed him ambassador to Algiers. And he and I did some business. Fine fellow. I had Saunders as my general assistant.
One second. Okay, I wanted to ask you one thing. How did the NSC operate under Kennedy in general?
Thank you, Albert. Well, before I talk about that, let me say, after I talk about it, the NSC operated very informally. We didn't really have much of an NSC. The president called very few NSC meetings. He preferred to be more informal and to get together a group of cabinet officers and others whom he wanted. And since the NSC had a rigid membership, he didn't want to see some of those fellows. He created his own. This continued right up. The XCOM in the Cuba Missile Crisis is a good example, where he put together his own XCOM and didn't call it the NSC. Well, the staff was very small. They'd been mostly paper shufflers in the Eisenhower years. Bundy wanted a few smart, substantive people, and I was one. He brought in Mike Forrestal. We only had 5 or 6 substantive guys. And we divided up the world.
He's the senior staff.
Yeah. There weren't any juniors, though. Well, there were a few assistants here and there. But basically, it was 5 or 6 people. And maybe a half dozen assistants. plus two or three special types. He made Bromley Smith, who had been on the previous ANSC staff, chief paper shuffler. He had another guy who watched out for security questions. And that was it. We operated very informally. We watched all the things in our area going on, read all the State Department cables, Defense Department stuff, lots of stuff from the agency, and all sorts of compartmented intelligence. And then when we decided, I generally took the initiative. If I decided I saw an upcoming problem, I'd write back a memo. If it was important enough and going to involve U.S. policy, I wrote the president a memo, which Mac naturally read. So it was an informal process during which a small number of bright guys generally took the initiative and raised problems up. But we also moved problems out. I was reading the same things the Assistant Secretary of State was reading, and I generally got them before he did. Now that was just because we had a very efficient distribution mechanism, and it was distributing to a dozen people, the President, the Assistant for National Security Affairs, and this group of six guys. Whereas over in the State Department, they're distributing to 1,000 people or more. So I would read a cable, I would see a problem, and I'd call Phil Talbot on the phone, or call Jim Grant, who was his deputy. And sometimes we'd have a little session. And I would attend the meetings at State or at Defense. I would call meetings of my own. And it worked very, very well. I must say the State guys were particularly congenial. And I had long felt that we were over-focused on the Arab-Israeli problem. And that we looked at the Middle East in terms of Erebus. And there were plenty of those at State. I felt, and so did Talbot and Jim Grant, that the key area from the standpoint of U.S. interests was the subcontinent. We ought to focus a lot more on India-Pakistan. And we did. So, but one of the very first problems we had was Iran. Because the Shah, who had been returned after Mossadegh, was feeling much more uncertain in his country. There was a certain increase in pressures, though the pressures were mostly domestic rather than foreign. He was frustrated. He was complaining. And it looked as though we were heading for maybe an overthrow or an attempted revolution. This raised the question, first off, of whether the Shah was an adequate instrument, whether the Shah could run things in Iran, or whether he was not likely to get picked off by his domestic opposition. And the question became one of, is the Shah modernized enough? Or enough of a modernizer to get along in the mid-20th century, or whether he didn't try to emphasize too much his divine right of kings, which we all knew came from World War I, and his father, who had been a sergeant in the Cossacks, and who had taken over, what, just about...
Early 20s, I think.
Yeah, just about the end of World War I. And the old man was a tough cookie, you remember, and the Brits kicked him out at the beginning of World War II. And the new Shah, we had had the Mossadegh affair when he left the country and came back. But I took the position that a known quantity, an old hand, who seemed to have some modernizing instincts, was a better bet than the possibility of, well, we didn't know who would take over, but we sure knew there'd be lots of trouble. And the Russians might mess around in it, Nasser might mess around in it, etc. So I proposed a task force I think it was the first or second task force which we had created under Kennedy. If this was another field expedient, it was an ad hoc. And I proposed that Phil Talbot be the head of the task force, and that I be the secretary. And one of the first things we decided was we needed a new ambassador. Well, we then had to find a new ambassador, and that's where Julius Holmes came in. I happened to know of Julius Holmes because he had commanded the civil affairs lash up in North Africa in World War II. He was a former army officer and had a very good record, very broad gauge, but he was one tough cookie. And he too thought the Shah was it.
Was what?
Was the guy we should continue backing rather than looking for new leadership. So in this task force, we first decided the question of whether the Shah was the last stop on an old railroad or the first stop on a new railroad. And we came up with various propositions and proposals. The Shah had a prime minister named Amini, who's still living. I think he's in London. And Amini had come up with the idea of a white revolution as the alternative to a red one.
The expression was his?
What?
The expression was his?
Yes.
He coined it.
I think he did.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe the Shah did, but I think it was Amini. And Amini came in with some reforms that seemed to work very well, and we were all very pleased with Amini's work. The Shah was also pleased. He was so pleased that he took over Amini's program, lock, stock, and barrel, and got rid of the prime minister so that he, the Shah, would get credit for the white revolution. And things went on that way. I never got to go out to Iran at that time, I don't think. But my contribution was the Shah was spending too much on the army. And it was a lousy, low-grade, inefficient army. So we recruited a regular brigadier general named Hamilton Twitchell. And we told Twitchell to go out to Iran for 3 months, or as long as it took him, and to try and convince the Shah that part of the white revolution should be cutting the size of the army.
Now, when did General Twitchell go to Iran?
You know, I think it was in 61, 62.
Okay.
I forget the precise time. But he actually convinced the Shah to cut 60,000 men out of the armed forces. And I never thought he could have done it. The Shah was so pleased with him that we sent him out as the head of the military mission. And he was there for 2 or 3 years, and then it was time for him to retire. And the Shah asked for him to come out and work for him as a private citizen. But we weren't prepared to do that. I was prepared to do it. I was prepared to extend Twitchell for another 3 years. I mean, anybody who can convince the Shah to do something the rest of us thought was impossible, pretty good.
Now, Twitchell came up with the idea of the five-year plan that tied military aid to reducing the size of the army.
Well,
that the
I don't
connection?
Recall that we tied military aid to it. We may have.
I think in
we may have.
Early 62.
Sounds like something I'd do. No, I wasn't. I'm not so sure that was Twitchell instead of me. But whoever it was a good idea. And it worked. And the Shah became the great protagonist of the White Revolution. Brought in a new prime secretary of agriculture and then prime minister. What was his name? The Azerbaijani.
Rassenjar? The agricultural secretary?
Yeah, Azerbaijan. No, what was his name?
Like Rassenjari, something like that.
No, I don't think so.
I don't have my notes here. So,
okay.
Yeah.
But anyway. And so the second Iranian crisis was survived by some adroit footwork on our part. The president was very pleased, Kennedy. And he kept writing letters, which I wrote, to the Shah, telling him problems were internal, that reform was difficult, but he, the Shah, was a great reformer, and we played the Shah like a violin.
I have some background questions about the task force that you discussed earlier,
yeah,
which I think was around May 61, as I
yes
recall. You suggested that there was some concern about internal instability in Iran. Was it more concerned about a possible military coup or more of a mass revolution, a popular revolution? Which was a higher...
Well, it was a revolution. It was clear how it would come. We weren't really thinking much of a military coup. But at the same time, we weren't thinking about mass revolution. Mm-hmm. It was hard to see what would happen.
To what extent did the policymakers and officials fear that the instability could produce an Iran with a neutral foreign policy posture? Was that a...
No, that wasn't much of a factor then. What we were thinking of was that a volatile Iran without a strong government would become prey to the Tudor Party and the USSR. That was what worried us more than anything else. Mm-hmm. Tudor was a significant political force.
Mm-hmm. Now, about the task force itself, who were some of the main participants besides Talbot and I guess yourself?
We had, I forget who we had from state, I mean from defense. Judith Holmes met with us several times. He was an ex officio member till he left and went out to Tehran. And we had another very strong noise from Bureau of the Budget, where an assistant director had just come back from 3 years working in Iran, and he thought he was very knowledgeable. And I liked him, and I thought some of his ideas were quite useful. State Department regarded him as an unmitigated nuisance.
Is it Kenneth Hansen?
Ken Hansen, yeah. Exactly right. You talked to Ken?
No, I think he's dead, but that's what I've been told.
Probably.
Yeah.
Makes me feel uncomfortable to find out that all these guys I worked with are dead.
That's what I've been told. I mean, don't know for a fact.
Well, ask away. My memory is sustaining itself so far, but...
What were some of Hansen's ideas in terms of the task force? Do you recall anything specific? Okay.
He liked the task force. Mm-hmm. He claimed to like what I was saying. He claimed to dislike what the State Department was saying, but I didn't see that much difference.
Were there any officials who suggested that perhaps the U.S. should withdraw support for the Shah and find alternative leadership?
Yes, I think there were. That was very actively discussed. But I can't connect it with any name at the present time. There were voices like that in the state. And we gave that a fair run, the whole thing, and ended up deciding that the Shah was still the best bet. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Now, during the month before the task force started out, Walt Rostow and Robert Johnson of the NSC staff had a meeting with an academic expert on Iran named T. Kyler Young. At Princeton. And according to the memo which I saw, Young suggested the only way to get action from the Shah on reform was through some sort of a shock treatment, like maybe withdrawing aid or cutting back on aid, something along those lines. To what extent did you or other NSC officials see shock treatment as an option, or was that discussed as an option?
Yes, we thought of it. Johnson and Rostow had nothing to do with this particular exercise. Uh-huh. I was the NSC rep. I can't recall that I ever kept, Bob Johnson, I didn't know quite where he fit in. But Rostow was Mac's deputy, and I think Mac asked me to keep him directly informed, keep him Bundy directly informed, i.e., let's keep Rostow to one side. I don't think Walt was much of an Iranian expert, but boy, he was made contributions on everything.
Uh-huh. I mentioned T. Tyler Young a minute ago. Did he meet with the task force or something like that?
No. Tyler Young as serving any role at all.
Okay.
I remember reading the memo, but I don't.
Did you discuss the task force report with President Kennedy to any extent?
Yes, when the task force finally came out with its conclusions, I probably sent them to Kennedy. I do not recall any discussion with him.
Well, did you get a sense in general what kind of a role that he thought the U.S. should play in Iran?
He generally went along with the conclusions we'd come up with.
Besides supporting the Shah, how would you characterize the general approach of the task force?
Promoting reform, cutting back the armed forces, who were taking an unconscionable amount of a rather limited budget. Then land reform was a big issue. That's where this other fellow came in. And under our urging, and I suspect urging from many Iranians, the Shah promoted a rather extensive land reform. I forget precisely when, but it was pretty good. And generated a lot of opposition, not least from the clergy, who, as in Europe centuries earlier, were losing some of the church lands.
Did you get a sense of President Kennedy's attitude toward the Shah? I've got the impression it was fairly critical.
Yes. I don't think Kennedy thought much of a guy who went around in these fancy uniforms. I don't think he was much impressed with the correspondence. But my impression was, I don't recall much in the way of presidential interjection in an early period. He didn't say, I think this and I think that, and I'd like that, those are your guidelines. But we mostly told him what we were thinking about and where we came out. And since he signed the letters and approved the recommendations, that showed us that we were on his frequency, or he was on ours. Life wasn't always like that. Kennedy had some very deep personal convictions on a lot of issues, like Yemen. My God, if there was ever a backward corner of the Arabian Peninsula, Yemen is it. But he was very actively interested in the war between the Yemeni royalists and the Republicans. And that's where I made my number with JFK. His secretary, Mrs. Lincoln, called me one day and said that the president was going to be talking with Macmillan, British Prime Minister, at Macmillan's request, and that the main item was going to be Germany, but that Macmillan also wanted to talk for a few minutes about Yemen, and the president wondered if I'd sit in. I said, of course. So she called back a couple of times during the day to make sure I hadn't forgotten, if I was going to forget that. And I went over to the sit room at 6:45 or something like that. Immediately thereafter, the president came in, lit up a cigar, said, Bob, I think that Macmillan's going to protest our intention to recognize the Yemeni Republic. The British were backing the nationalists. And he said, I'd just like to have you around. I'm no expert on Yemen, but if I run out of gas, maybe you can help me. Well, my phone rang. It was Macmillan. He and the president disposed of Germany in about 5 minutes. And then Macmillan turned to Yemen. And it was clear that he was pleading with the president to postpone, if not to completely discard our proposed recognition of the Republic. And Kennedy gave him all my answers. My God, he gave them as if he had just read all the memos I'd written him in the previous 6 months. And Macmillan wasn't having any, and Macmillan came back and re-argued, so Kennedy went through the whole thing again. And Macmillan still wasn't having any, and the president, I could see, was getting a little frustrated. But finally, he says to Macmillan, he says, look, neither of us is an expert on this, and I have my expert sitting here right with me, and I'll have him talk to you. Well, what can McMillan say? And he hands me the telephone. I almost died. I mean, I had never talked with McMillan. I had seen McMillan in action during World War II. But I phoned Prime Minister, and he said, yes, Mr. Comer. And then he called me Mr. Cohen, because he hadn't gotten it very good. I said, no, Comer, Prime Minister. He said, well, look, I've been arguing with the president about you're recognizing that's going to embarrass us. And he gave me the whole song and dance he'd given the president twice. So I just went back at him and said, now look, as one of the experts involved, I want to tell you how we look at it. I went whap, 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 whap. My confidence grew. And I had a big discussion with McMillan for about 20 minutes. And we went rather deeply into some of the issues. And the president, instead of leaving, is sitting right there smoking his cigar and listening to this debate with a smile. And so finally McMillan says, well, Mr. Comer, you're pretty articulate on this subject, and I can't think of any more reasons to advance. So you can tell the president that we'll go along, we'll live with it. And he said, I presume the president is gone. I said, no, sir. He's sitting right here watching me perform. And I hand the phone back to the president. Kennedy gets on. He said, you see, let's see, what was McMillan's first name?
Harold.
You see, Harold, I was right. McMillan must have said something, well, you win on points for the time being. And the cordial goodbye. Well, I was elated. Here I had, in the presence of the President of the United States, had a debate with the British Prime Minister, and I had won. Well, that really made me feel good. So I dropped by Bundy's office to clue him. He wasn't there, so I left a message and went home. It was by now about 8 o'clock. Next morning, I got to the office. My usual tardy arrival about 9:15, and my secretary said, Bundy has called about 15 times. He wants to talk to you immediately. So I said, oh, shit. And I went over to Bundy's office. He said, Bob, what the hell happened last time? I said, Mac, I told you what happened. I left a message for you when you weren't here. And he took that and said, well, I want to tell you what happened after you left. I got back to the office about 8, and there was a call immediately thereafter from the president. The president said, who's that guy? Comer. And Max said, I've told you about him 50 times. He's been here since the beginning, and he was a couple of classes behind you at Harvard. Well, the president said, I hadn't noticed him much before, but I want to tell you, that guy knows the Yeaman thing cold. And he talked down McMillan. And then he asked a few more questions about me. That was the end of the conversation. Well, Max said, I want to tell you, you have now become a person in JFK's mind. And he has noticed you. And let me tell you, from here on, you're doing business directly with him. I'd appreciate it if when you send me him a memo, you send me one too. The same thing, so I know what the hell is going on. But let me tell you, from now on, the president will call you frequently. He'll call you directly instead of calling you through me. And he will know who you are, so you deal with him directly. Well, I didn't quite believe it, but it meant I had arrived. That very afternoon, phone rang, it was the president. Was Jack Kennedy, and he had some silly ass question, and I answered it.
But what time was what year was this?
This, I think, was late 62. Mm-hmm. And from then on, I was a marked man. And the president thought of me, and he invited me to all sorts of affairs. He sent me off to the Persian, to the Middle East with LBJ. And it was true. I had arrived. And I feel sure that if Kennedy had not been assassinated, I would at some point have been raised up higher because I had his confidence. It's funny. comes because I'm there at his request at a phone discussion with Harold McMillan. And he used to consult me on everything under the sun. We had state visits, you know, everybody and his brother. Along came the Saudi Prime Minister, the Somali Prime Minister, Abdi Rashid. The State Department sent over a briefing book, and it was miserable. Kennedy took a look at this stuff, and he said, "Al, I can't give these toasts or welcoming statements." Calls me up, he says, "Bob, have you read this crap?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I read it." He said, "It's no good." I said, "It ain't very good." Well, he said, "I want you to do something about it. Do me a new toast, a new welcoming statement, a new this and that." Well, God, I looked at my watch. The Somali was coming at 11, and it was already 9:30. I had an hour and a half to do what I guess some guy had stayed and worked on for a week. So I didn't quite know what to do. So then it struck me, find somebody who knows something about Somalia. Well, I knew one guy. He was in the agency. I called him up. I said, "I got a problem." I described it in fewer words than these. And I said, "For God's sake, what can I say about Somalia?" And about, well, he said, I can't help you. I can't think of anything that would be striking and theatrical, et cetera, et cetera. He said, "Well, you know, these Somalis are the Irishmen of Africa." I said, "What?" "That's what they're called, the Irishmen of Africa." "Well," I said, "tell me no more. I've got what I need." So I wrote a nice little arrival statement about the Irishmen of Africa. Kennedy loved it. He used the Irishmen of Africa in about 15 statements while poor Abdi Rashid was here. And then at the end, he called me up. He said, "Bob, you have firmly recommended that we do nothing for the Somalis, because we're tied in with the Ethiopes, and those two don't get along." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Can't we do something for these guys? They are very attractive. They really are the Irishmen of Africa." And I said, "No, sir, Mr. President. I'll think about it, and I'll try and come up with something useless." I was being critical. I said, "But it ain't a good bet." 2 years later, Dergis come in Addis Ababa. The Somalis are pushed to one side by the Soviets. The Soviets take over the Ethiopes. Then we take over the Somalis. Now we've got Somalia and they've got Ethiopia. They're two fine countries, both being miserably mismanaged. Well, it wasn't a good trade. But at any rate, I really loved that. Kennedy had a great sense of humor. Then, you know, they had sent Vice President Johnson off to the Far East. He'd gone down to Saigon and called Nodin Ziemwa.
The Churchill of Asia.
The Churchill of Asia, and the best leader the country, any country could have. And he'd gone to Pakistan and picked up the camel driver and all that kind of stuff. And so he said to the president, "Look, Mr. President, the State Department was supposed to give me political backing and advice. They did a lousy job. They did as well as they could." Johnson was not very controllable. So he said, "I'm not going to go to the Middle East unless you send Mack Bundy with me." Mack was in the room along with Kennedy and LBJ. And Kennedy picked it up so fast. He said, "Look, Bundy's not my Middle East guy. Bob Comer is." And Bundy said, "That's absolutely right. I don't do anything east of the Suez. Comer does all of the Middle East." And LBJ, quite understandably, says, "Who the hell is Comer? What are you doing?"
Turn it over in a second.
Oh.
Turn it out of there.